CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everybody. Haha. You are here with us, Pumi and I, and we're looking after you this morning through the course of the first hour, which is all kinds of good stuff. And then we get to the second hour, which is, of course, the Burning Platform. That is where we talk about all the things that are happening in the world. We're going to be joined this morning by somebody Pumi's found called Nicole Fritz. I'll tell you about her in a short while. See, Pums, occasionally they manage to find the people that you're really after talking to. So she's the executive director of the Helen Suzman Foundation and was a business day economist. She's also served in several prominent civil society positions and organizations over her career, including being the executive director of Freedom Under Law. We know how important they are. They've been fighting lots of really important stuff in the courts for us ordinary South Africans. So we'll talk to her about lots of good things in the Burning Platform later on. But first things first, how are you doing, Pums?
Y'all have to, like, bring me up to speed about what's happened in the past couple of days. I feel like I've been in a hole.
Where have you been?
I've rural. All my rural development life.
What you've been doing.
Out in the sticks. I've been out in the States.
Yeah.
Yesterday I was at a tribal council.
Oh, really? How did, just give?
Yeah, they let people like me into those things.
Let me into it. I want to know how those things work. What kinds of things get discussed? What goes down at these tribal councils? Most South Africans, the only tribal council on there is the one from Survivor.
It's a little bit like that, right? Mm. There's all the indunas, there's the chief, and all the indunas sit around. And yesterday they were actually in the hall. There were a lot of people when we got there. It starts at about 10 in the morning.
Yeah.
And people from the village come. So people from the village come. Some are there to make requests about pieces of land, to expand. You know, if your children are grown up, you can always, like, you can ask the chief for more land, and you get a piece of land, and they can go and start their own homestead.
Oh, right.
Lots of disputes.
Yeah. And are these disputes about land, about property, about?
About lots of things, about, like, community issues. Like, there's in this particular community, one of the issues that has suddenly kind of become a problem, a big problem, is the drunkenness of young people. You know, last week we spoke about the chavs.
Yeah, of course.
So they have a similar situation, whereas young people, there's people in the community who brew a pineapple beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then all these young people, because, you know, we have an unemployment issue for all our young people. So there's lots of young people sitting around in the villages.
Drinking.
And drinking this pineapple beer that makes everybody. And then they're like lawless.
Yeah.
They won't listen to anyone. And then they've now started kind of robbing people that are coming home from the grocery stores. So you've got your little, like, groceries in your bags of Checkers or whatever it is.
It's exactly like the chavs. It's exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. It just shows you. Exactly. You could be in the middle of London, or you could be in, like, rural South Africa, and the youth are doing the same stupid things.
This is what happens with kind of, like, youths that don't have anything to do out there. Because that's what it is, right? Yeah. They don't have anything
boredom,
to do. There's
unemployment.
Just too much time on their hands, and there's a whole group of you. Then you get to doing stupid things.
Huh. So this is what they do in the tribal council. So is the chief's word final, or are there a bunch of elders who support the chief in all of this? I mean, how does it all work?
So it's all the indunas
with
the chief. So these are the elders.
Mm-hmm.
That are with the chief, and they all the, like, indunas work a little bit like your counselor, you know. So here in the city, you'd have, well, you know who your counselor is.
Yeah.
They are your first point of contact. So that when you don't bring every little thing to the chief, you bring like the
big things,
weighty, meaty issues. Yeah. And at this chief has a huge a community center. This is where the hall is, where they have the chief's meetings, and he has these meetings every Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And at the community center, there's a computer center for young people.
Oh.
But still, you know,
there's sure.
a computer center with like about 50 computers.
Yeah.
And teachers and all sorts. And there's a little bit, there's lots of land. They have lots of land out there.
And
there was also a guy there yesterday from Vodacom. I don't know what he was about to say, but he looked quite nervous.
Mm.
I think he's there to like look for a tower. To look for space to put up a tower.
Well, it's true that these councils have enormous and wide-ranging powers in the rural areas. I mean, you can't just build something. You can't just start farming. You know, people think it's just a free-for-all, but it really isn't. I mean, obviously, mm. obviously there's some chiefs who are more, let's say, fastidious and conscientious than others. But normally, if you wanted to build a shop somewhere, you need their permission.
Yeah.
If you want to start growing things, you need their permission. So it's almost a little bit like, as the way you're describing it, it almost sounds like a little bit of a cross between sort of a community where there's an appointed head. In this case, it's usually an inherited chiefdom, and the Ndunas are the mm-hmm. same, but it's a bit like also like feudalism. In Europe, that's kind of how it goes, right?
It is, because it's – so the community land is also, you know, even though it's jointly owned and it's got to be – you know, it's in everybody's interest and whatnot, it's also got to have some kind of rule structure. So,
sure.
And some of these things – and this is a very contentious thing here in South Africa, and quite recently there was an act that – there are two things that are very contentious, particularly in KZN.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, in KZN, huge tracts of land are owned by Ingonyama Trust. We've spoken
yes.
about this with Canton.
Yes.
They're not owned by the Ingonyama Trust, but they are presided over
yes.
by Ingonyama Trust. And then there's also familial land, right? So land that belonged to my great-grandfather
mm-hmm.
that's been passed down. And all of those, and these are some of the things that become issues, right? Particularly in families, is who is the person that inherits the land that was Mkulu's land,
right?
And of all the grandchildren, you know, you have 10 grandchildren.
Well, I mean, we saw this. That, we also saw this unfold when when the Zulu king died, when Zwelithini died, mm. and Mrs. Mm. Zulu eventually took over because they had to adjudicate and decide who's. You know, who's the new boss. Now, I mean, this is interesting because a lot of people say that, oh, you know, Africa has very different, you know, specifically like tribal and rural Africa and South Africa in this case, very, very different systems. But actually, it's not that different. And the ordinary issues that those communities are facing every day are pretty much the same as the issues in almost everywhere else. You said London, you know, with young people drinking. But I mean, the property stuff, and this is another area of great contentiousness, is like, you know, no, property is something that was imposed on, you know, black people by white people. And there is obviously some truth to that, because there were some white people who just seized property in the course of like the last 400 years. But property has always been an important part of how chiefs have administered their authority. You can own, as you say, familial property, which is sometimes clearly inherited by the eldest son or the son, one of the other sons, one of the daughters in very rare circumstances, but it does happen. And then you've got the communal land. And people just ignore the familial land part of this because it doesn't suit some kind of political narrative, right?
It really is quite fascinating. But also what I've learned over the past couple of months as we've been doing this work,
mm-hmm.
we have now met a chief in Limpopo. I told you guys about that, the chief of the Tsonga-speaking people.
Yes.
This chief that we met was a Sotho chief. even though he's in KZN. I told you about that as well. And recently met the chief of the Ndebele.
Oh, yeah?
And they are all pretty young. They right. are all pretty young. They're about our age. They're in their 40s, which also has a dynamic, right? It also has a dynamic in that you've got a young chief who's got modern views of how the world is supposed to kind of reorganize themselves, and also surrounded by a lot of older indunas, you know? So there's a dynamic of the power relation, and there's the old and the new. There's kind of how do we go into the 20, as we are now into the going into that 22nd century, hey?
Well, it is
a new world.
I mean, it really is interesting, and I love hearing about this stuff, especially from you, because you're on the ground looking at it. And while you didn't have no knowledge of this stuff before, your kind of experience is helping inform me, because we also have massive reforms to do in this country, rural and urban. And as these reforms are enacted, in some places they are very fiercely resisted because people don't want anyone messing with their traditions or their ways that they've done things for hundreds of years. In other places, people are demanding change because they're like, it's not working anymore, right?
And it's going to be. And every time I come on the show and we talk about what the future looks like for South Africa, and I keep saying to you guys that I think there's going to be like shifts and ructions and that are unbelievable. And I get like blowback. But that's what I see.
It does sound also like a lot of it will be disintermediated. In other words, there won't be as much central control. And the places that seem to work the best are usually the places where people are deciding for themselves which rules to keep, which ones to reform, which ones to get rid of. And I think that's much easier in a rural, homogenous environment where everybody speaks the same language, there is a common tradition. Do you think it's easier, or do you think it's easier in suburbia? Like you've spoken to us about this is such a microcosm, right? The whole tribal thing that you just described. And then your complex you live in and the way you describe that wall situation, it's very similar. I have to say, it's like the only difference is that you're applying to the city council on the one hand, who may or may not be better or worse or more bureaucratic or more like backward, or the chief in the rural area, who may be all those things as well.
Yeah, and all of the various modes of communication, right? Mm. So I have my irritating WhatsApp group in my complex.
Right.
There's a community WhatsApp group.
Right. So they're using modern technology to like let people know about things.
It really, really is a very complex is the closest word to it, but also very mind-bending.
Right.
Very mind-bending. And then we worry about, so then I come back to Joburg and, you know, look at the paper, look at what's on Twitter, on the internet, and on the main papers, and everybody's issue around carbon footprints and all of that. And I think out there, the biggest issue, almost universally, is water, access to water.
Wow. That's the big thing, and we've been hearing about this for ages, and people have been talking about, oh, there's a water, but for those people, they've never had like reliable running water. They have to fetch it from rivers and from wells and from taps that are often kilometers away from where they are, and it takes up a huge proportion of their time and a massive amount of energy, and that's for something which should be accessible. This is the whole reason that we have a Ministry of Water.
And it is absolutely irritating and awful in every way to see it and experience it. It really is. But those are the issues that people vote about, right? Those are the issues that people vote on.
But also, when we, it kind of it does make you think, like, our problems are not that different, no matter where you are. They really aren't. They aren't that different. So this is going to be an issue for people in suburbia very soon, if it isn't already. We have had vast parts of Johannesburg that have been, they've had water shutdowns, you know. Just in my neighborhood yesterday, there was a notice going around that they were shutting down certain pipes, repairing, doing maintenance. And obviously, in some areas, they haven't done maintenance for ages. So it's coming for us as residents of the suburbs or the urban areas as well. And if you haven't experienced that yet, get ready, because it's going to be an issue for you. And meanwhile, I see Senzo Mtunu is the Minister of Water Affairs. I mean,
hey, guys, Senzo Mtunu. Do you remember that name? Do you even remember that name?
I mean,
do people know what Senzo looks like?
It takes me a long time to try and remember who Senzo Mtunu was. Right?
Also, another one that's been in power, in the government in various guises for way too long.
Just don't forget that Lindiwe Sisulu was that minister until August last year, right? So he's new there now, but you know who the deputy ministers were? Pam Chwete and David Mahlobo. Now, Mahlobo was obviously the idiot who was in charge of intelligence for a while, and he's completely useless. So I don't know. I don't know what you make of that. And before that, it was Tokyo Sekhwale in the first. Nomvula Mokonyane, but it was Tokyo Sekhwale in the first in the Mandela administration, who was Minister of Human Settlements and then Water and Sanitation. They were all merged into the cabinet in one. That was one of the few ministries that was eventually put into another ministry instead of extrapolated out, because you know how many of those there are too. Where they've, like, taken, okay, well, we need water, then we need sanitation, then we need human settlements. They've put these together, amalgamated them. But anyway, we'll have to see whether Senzo Mtunu is even at home to do any of this work. I mean, it's so funny. Some of the comments here, people are saying, you know, Bongi says, it sounds a bit like Westeros in Game of Thrones. Right, and then Sanele says, you took the words right out of my mouth. And Bongi says, it's all fun and games until someone wants to run all the kingdoms. that has happened. You know, again, I was listening to a really interesting lecture on South African history. And they were talking about the Eastern Cape and those kingdoms that were at war with each other during the time when the Trekboers and the then Governor General of the Cape, Lord Charles Henry Somerset, were all at war with each other. And it's not as if it was just easy. It was, you could figure it out. Well, the English and the Trekboers were fighting, or the English and the Trekboers were fighting the Xhosa. And then you saw that even in the AmaXhosa, there were, like, huge divisions. There were some who were, like, deliberately trying to make alliances with the English so that they could get certain privileges. There were others who were trying to ally themselves with the Trekboers. There were others who would not deal with other AmaXhosa chiefs. I mean, if you don't study this stuff in detail, it's very easy to make broad brush strokes. I mean, it's like people will say about tribal councils, oh, well, that's an antiquated way of doing things. But if you don't actually take the trouble to go there and to learn, like you are, about what people's issues are, you really don't have any room to argue about it on Twitter. You don't know enough.
And you know, out there, so in the areas that we've been in over the past two, three months, it's those battlefields, right? It's Rorke's Drift, it's the Sandwana, all of those, Van Rienen's Pass, those battlefields. So, like, you're just steeped in the history of it all. Very exciting for a history nerd like me.
Well, in September, I'm actually going to see some of those battlefields, which I've been threatening to do for ages, and I'm finally doing it in September this year. So that's next month. I cannot wait.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I mean,
where are you going?
So it's a place called Three Trees Lodge, I think, and I'm very, very excited to go. I've never been to, like, northern KZN. I mean, I've driven through it on the way to the coast, but I've always wanted. I remember I spoke to you about this, Pumi, and we were going to arrange a whole thing, and like Muzi was going to take me and everything. We may still do that. Who knows? But I know how busy you guys have been. But
we might bump into each other because we're going down in September again.
We may do. I mean, it'll be amazing. I would love that. If we can organize to like coincide the trips, that would be phenomenal. But yeah, that's going to be happening.
Okay, offline conversation. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think that would be amazing. So, I mean, I'm just blown away by like the history of KZN. Did I show you this book, which I'm also making my way through? Hold on a second. So I'm reading this, which is The New History of South Africa with Herman Guillemier, who's one of our great historians, Bernard Mbenga, who's at the Northwest University, and Bill Nassen, who's at the University of the Western Cape. And while a lot of this is kind of – the biggest part of it is focused on post-94, right? There's a huge amount of really detailed history in here about fascinating stuff that happened in KwaZulu-Natal, which is where – like for many of – the origin stories of South Africa and its people, it happened in that province, and it's such an interesting like balance of power that happened there, because really the Zulu kingdom was enormous and powerful and influential. It met head to head with, you know, these emigres, these white Boers who'd come from originally Holland and Germany and France, and who now were looking for a place to live. And, you know, there was this huge difference in culture and language and history and everything. And then you've got, you know, the mighty British Empire. And they all kind of met. And it was totally unpredictable which way it could go. There were battles that were completely won by one side. There were battles that were won completely by the other side. And there were battles where it was very hard to figure out which one and adjudicate which one actually won. And I think, you know, if you're going to make sort of broad and generalized statements about the history of South Africa, you're just missing out on so many of the great stories. You know, you're missing out on the incredible, as you said earlier, complexity of these stories.
We could totally make our own Game of Thrones. That would blow. It would totally.
Well,
there's a remake of Shaka. Somebody is doing it. Was a friend of mine who's a casting director.
Oh, yeah?
And they have been casting with a huge international production.
Yes.
A remake of Shaka Zulu.
Well, do you remember the original one with Henry Gale?
I still have it.
For me,
watch it every. My best friend and I still watch it every now and again. Just, you know,
as a child.
A reminder of.
As a child, I loved that show so much. Now, I know there was quite a lot of like violence and stuff that should upset children. I was obsessed. When I tell you obsessed, I was like, I would do all the dress-ups at school, either as, you know, one of those umtagati or the sangomas or as shaka. Like, I was obsessed with it. There was a place in the mountains near us where we lived, where they'd recreated a Zulu homestead of the, like, 1700s.
Oh, wow.
And it was authentic. And the people who lived there still lived in the same huts. They built the same way. They would make, you know, the same traditional weapons. They would make their food the same way. It was called Pezul. And we would go there. And I used to beg my mother to take me. And I forced my brother to go with me as well because we just loved this thing. I was – no. It was a proper, like, obsession. I was into it in a big way, hey? And I remember we
can you see how many people in the comments are doing the soundtrack? Boom, boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, I love that. Bayete, Nkosi. Wasn't that also, that was Margaret Singana, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. No, I remember that stuff. And then I went and I became obsessed with visiting like places where like significant things had happened, but obviously it was had to be close to where we lived because my poor mother wasn't going to drive like miles and miles and miles into like northern KwaZulu-Natal. But we did go to the original site of Dingaan's homestead of Mgongondlovu, which was quite a way from home, and you know that
is quite a way.
Yeah, but that was interesting. I mean, I could have spent days and days and days there. And you know, I'm talking about being a kid of somewhere between 12 and 14.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing that your poor mother.
Yeah, poor mother. But I also I used to have all this paraphernalia. Like I bought a cowhide shield and an assegai, an ikwa, and I had I promise you, I had all this stuff all over my room for years. I've still got all of it somewhere. I've got that shield somewhere in the house here. And the whole story of Shaka, I became obsessed. And then afterwards, Dingaan, and then after Dingaan, Mpande, and after Mpande, Chwayo, and so on and on. And, you know, to me, that stuff is such rich South African history. I just wish people would take an interest in their own back garden rather than worrying so much about what's going on in, you know, Brazil or America or China or anything else, because we've got stories to tell. I must tell you, it's good shit. Mm. It's really good shit. So here's an interesting story. Zuzile's said, I was in Kwadukuza with friends on Saturday and we visited King Shaka's grave, which is a must visit. Yeah. There's actually quite a lot of controversy because they're not entirely sure if it's exactly the place where he was buried, but they've now erected a statue there and it's got some like protection around it in terms of like fences and things. But for a long while, obviously it wasn't looked after. And they say that it may be that there was a little bit of confusion as to exactly where he was buried, but we know it's somewhere near Stanga in Kwadukuza. Mm. And people have more or less determined that that's where it most likely is. But wow, fascinating history there. And the way he obviously died and kind of, you know, this incredible internecine battle.
Stand in the back.
Yeah, by his brothers, no less. Sanele says, we're cut from the same cloth, G. I ate Shaka Zulu up. I cried like a little bitch when they betrayed him and stabbed him in the back. Yeah. I mean, now, you know, now we obviously have so much revisionist history going on, and people are starting to write the story more from, because in that Shaka story, he was obviously the hero. And Dingaan was the villain. But people are saying that there may be more to it. There always is with history, right? You know, we all like,
of course,
we like to see people as good people or bad people. And, you know, in every single slice of human history, there's always like villains and heroes. And for a long, long time, Dingaan was the villain. And people are now saying, well, actually, Shaka had become very power hungry. He'd lost his mind. He'd become extremely violent. He was unpredictable. The kingdom was like very uneasy and restless.
What weakened him was the death of his mother.
Absolutely.
And this is,
Nandi.
This is not an unknown history, but what weakened him was the death of his mother and how distraught he was by it. And initially, there was the period of mourning, which is always, the demise of kings will always be around when the nation is uneasy. And it was in the period of mourning, which he kept extending, and therefore people couldn't plant, and there was famine encroaching on the land. And this is where the rise up, because people, for a long time, people did, because everybody loves a strong leader. Everybody loves a strong leader. You feel protected. You feel, but as his grief overtook him, and therefore he no longer cared about the issues of the kingdom.
Well, he also ordered people to put their livestock to death because he said, well, if I've lost my mother, then every calf in the kingdom must lose its mother. And there were all these cows put to death for no good reason except Shaka being sad, you know? And
that was where, so I mean, this is, you know, this is what weakens kingdoms.
Yeah.
Even if you look at us and our strife in this country, right? Is what makes people unhappy is when their lives are immediately impacted by the Game of Thrones, by what is happening over there in the, you know, ivory towers of power.
Mm-hmm.
When it starts to hit my pocket, when it starts to, the cost of traveling, the cost of fish oil, then strife, and then the people revolt.
Vyasin says, I lived in Zululand for 13 years. The first 13 years, it's beautiful. Mm. I'm sure. Tracy saying Sugar had serious mommy issues. It's true. You wouldn't have said that to him. You would have been impaled. Yeah. And then I was just starting to think that maybe the weather was getting better, because yesterday was actually lovely. I mean, I spent a lot of the day in a t-shirt and jeans. And Rebellious Ruth says, oh no, this Sunday and Monday is going to be freezing. There's snow expected on the Drakensberg. Ugh. Really? I knew it was too good to be true. Shit.
Winter never leaves without drama. Winter never leaves. Just quietly leaves and summer starts. There's always drama. There's always that last, ha-ha.
Yeah. It has to give you a, it has to stab you in the back like Sugar's brothers. All right. Well, that was a very interesting half hour. And forgive me if you're not that into Zulu history, but I can't help myself. And Pumi's telling me about the modern way that things are adjudicated in tribal councils. And it just got me going down that story of kind of where it all started. And I love this stuff. So if it was boring for you, I promise we'll stop now.
It's good for us. It's good for all of us.
It's time to check out some headlines, though. Let's see what's going on. First of all, Mark Zuckerberg has announced new privacy features for WhatsApp. Do you want to hear about this? Because every time he does this, I get a little bit nervous. They've decided that they will be able to leave group chats silently. They will be able to. That's us. We can control who sees our online status. And we can block screenshots on view once messages. That's interesting. So, for example...
What? Block screenshots on...
Yeah. So, you know, you can send someone a view once message. So, I suppose this is for what? For sexting? That's the only reason I could think people would want to send a view once picture. It's like if you're sending someone...
Maybe they have, like, sedition on the mind. People are... sending.
maybe it's like treasonous stuff. Bongi says, I hope Palapala is listening. Well, you see, that's exactly it. Palapala will not be able to go after you for your messages, because you can view them once. So you could create a picture where you've written something down on a piece of paper, for example, and you could take a picture of that and send a view once picture to somebody, even to a group. And if they take a screenshot, first of all, it will not allow a screenshot.
You won't let it. Yeah.
But I suppose you also get notified that someone tried to take a screenshot. That would be interesting. Because I always think, like, there's some people who just do not understand how privacy works, right? And they'd be prepared to use nefarious means. I suppose what you could still do if you wanted to is maybe take a picture with another device of that screen. There's no way you can't stop that, right?
But you know what is always mind-blowing for me is, even on Twitter, there are those people, you know, there people will put out a tweet and then delete it.
Yes.
But there's always somebody with the screenshot of that tweet. Yeah, and I'm like,
these people must be busy 24
24/7. This tweet.
Right. Who's doing this? Who's actually going around and screenshotting this much? Who's storing all these images?
I'm just like, I'm always like, there's always somebody with the screenshot. The thing was up for 30 seconds. There's somebody with the screenshot.
Well, I'm amazed. Tracy says, I watched the most hated man on the internet lately. Yes, like, what a douchebag that Hunter Moore is. do you know about this?
I've been meaning to watch that.
No, I haven't seen this.
There's too much happening. I've fallen so behind with TV watching, guys. And y'all know how much I love my TV. But I've fallen so behind. There's a new Umbrella Academy I haven't seen.
Okay.
There's like too much
stuff. Lots of stuff. Let's look at some other news. So just quickly on that Zuckerberg story, there are a couple other things. So the nice thing, I suppose, about leaving a group silently, it will allow people to disable this for individual group chats. The option to leave silently will not be presented to users when they choose to exit groups, sometimes causing awkwardness, embarrassment, or drama for those trying to leave unnoticed. I don't understand why this is a big issue. And to me, this plays to weakness. Like, you should be able to say, guys, I'm out of this group. It's actually a statement, and I think it's quite helpful to say this person has left the group. Also, the rest of the people know then. I think this is like weaselly. I think the kind of people who leave a group in a weaselly, silent way are the kind of people who don't have the courage of their convictions. I'm against this. I'm against this. I don't like it at all. With the recent changes, also they're saying they're focused on building product features that empower people to have more control and privacy over their messages. No other global messaging services at this scale provide this level of security. This is all obviously to, you know, make them sound like they're doing really great things. Unless users are prompted to use the features or made fully aware of them in the app, their impact could be limited. And then they talked also about Snapchat. On Tuesday, Snap also announced new features for instant image sharing, as well as updates to the messaging app. Apparently what they're going to do is try and create a more child-friendly environment. Family center tools include letting parents see who their child is friends with and chatting to, but the parents will not be able to view the message content. For parents, we know understanding how their teens are interacting online is very important. The in-app family center will let parents independently report users interacting with their child or engaging in concerning behavior on Snapchat. From autumn, teen users will be able to notify parents of any account or content which they have reported. So, I mean, that's good stuff. I just wonder if it goes far enough. Obviously, this is something, you know, a lot of parents will be worried about. Does it all go far enough? And how can you make these changes work?
Gareth, did I tell you about this new book that I'm reading?
No.
About WeChat?
No.
Oh, my goodness. You remember WeChat when we started?
Sure.
Cliff Central, WeChat was on the... And WeChat, which is owned by Tencent.
Yes.
And Tencent is really one of the reasons that Naspers is still making money every day. And this book is called Influence Empire by a guy named Lulu Chen. And it's about the rise of WeChat and the founder of WeChat and how it became, because in China, you cannot do anything without WeChat.
Yeah.
Everything from kind of calling your Uber to paying for it, going to the movies, getting food, everything is so interconnected. WeChat has created what Mark Zuckerberg can only like dream about, right. I think, right? In that they have a monetary system, they have many, many users.
Don't they also have
different components?
Aren't they the major tool for the social credit system as well?
They absolutely are.
That's the scary part, right?
They absolutely are. But that's because they have so much... And you remember, I think a lot of people kind of in the West only really heard about WeChat after Donald Trump's outburst. Remember when Donald Trump had the outburst about like shutting down WeChat, and then there was a there was a court case about it, which they won because that Donald Trump little outburst took WeChat from being in the kind of 1,000th most downloaded app on the various Play Stores in the Western half of the world to being in the top 50. And I think that's what old Zuckerberg is hoping for here. He's hoping for that with all these privacy settings, all of the stuff, because they've really struggled to get into mainland China, which everybody wants to do because there are so many people there.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. You know, their Game of Thrones is having as many users as possible, is that maybe it'll make people want to come onto their platform.
Well, I think all of these platforms are nefarious, but to me, the WeChat story isn't one of like, oh, great success and incredible integration. It's creepy as hell. I don't like the because of course it's administered by an authoritarian government, right?
No, but it's a private company. And the thing about it for me, What's really fascinating just in this story is understanding how much people are willing to give up these personal freedoms and information for convenience. It's just easier for me to do these 10 things on this one thing, okay, then I'll let you have. Yep. Because I mean, people are opting into it, right? People are opting into it, but opting into it because of convenience and entertainment. It's incredible.
Yeah, I won't be doing that. I'm not going to be opting into any of that shit. I mean, I don't like the idea of being... In fact, I really think that these VPNs are essential, these virtual private networks, these things that cut you off from the social media companies and the platforms and the Googles being able to monitor you so they can sell your information to advertisers. I actually want to go out of my way to make it difficult for them. You know, I don't want to comply with this system. And it's because, as we discussed at the beginning of COVID, 30% of the people are just rebellious. They don't want to be a part of things. That's me. 30% of the people are totally compliant. They can't wait to join in. They throw all their stuff in with whoever's in charge. And then you get the ones who are like 40% of the people who need to be convinced. And I know which group I belong to. I'm always extra suspicious of the enormous overreach that politicians in government are capable of. I don't see governments generally as being an overall good because they're administered by people, and people are just full of fallibility. So I would, in any situation, I would rather rely on myself than on authorities. And then we talk about big companies, and I get even more nervous because big companies, you don't have a say in at all. Like, at least in government, you can convince yourself, well, I've got a vote, or I can call up my MP, or I can, you know, complain about the president on social media or whatever. But if you're on the social media platform and you complain about them and they block you, there's no like arbitration or mediation process that you can get back on. And also, they have all this info on you, which to me feels a little bit like a bullying situation, if you ask me. So I don't love that. Anyway, I mean, I certainly don't trust the Chinese government, and I'm still waiting for the world to give them and to hold them responsible for the last 2.5 years of chaos that we've had on the planet, because it was definitely between them and Dr. Fauci's gain of function research, they owe us more explanations than we've been given. And the WHO should be on that. Of course, they won't be. But that's not conspiratorial even. If I'd said this 2 years ago, of course, I would have been shut down on the internet. But now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask those questions and to expect answers from them. So Giga Shack says, the Chinese government insists that people use WeChat to access rail and all those other things. You can't, like Pumi says, you can't actually exist in China without WeChat. Giga Shack also says, my son was forced to use WeChat everywhere he went, not voluntarily, but it is convenient. There's no cash. Yes, but they can also shut you down, right? They can absolutely shut you down. And then the social credit system comes into it. And if they decide that you're a non-person, imagine you can't travel, you can't spend your own money, you can't spend it on the things you want to spend it on. That to me is real. That's Orwellian. It's the only way to describe it. All right, enough of that story. There's other stuff going on too. So this is concerning. Universities that do not meet requirements may be downgraded or closed. That's according to new draft rules that aim to differentiate types of educational institutions. According to the changes, a university must offer a wide range of studies or be classified as a college. University South Africa's Linda Mayer says people can still comment on the proposed policy. You need to have 95% of your programs registered on the higher qualification framework. You also need to have a very strong research component, she said. Institutions of higher learning, specifically universities, focus on teaching and learning, research and community engagement. So, I mean, does that all sound kind of obvious?
It sounds very nefarious. For me.
Again, well, you know, politics.
You know what fascinates me about this? Yeah, you know what fascinates me about this is that we and our government pays lots of lip service to the Freedom Charter, because that's who the ANC people were, right? They were the Freedom Charterists.
Right.
And one of the key components of that Freedom Charter, I think it's number 2 or 3, is that the doors of learning shall be opened.
Okay.
And yet we have a government that is so keen on closing down opportunities for more people to be part of learning. Right? Like, you've got to have these 20 hurdles to jump through before people, we can classify you this particular thing. Oh, yeah. No, in order to send your child to a primary school, you have to sign up to this portal and we will decide and centralize everything. Such bullshit.
It is bullshit. Are you, because, you know, your son's not.
They should be creating more opportunities for more people to access learning. So no. Shutting down universities.
It's become.
We already have a problem. We already have a problem in that our universities cannot handle the volume of young people that want to get into university. And here they are going, actually, we're just going to make it even more difficult.
Well, obviously, they're controlling their own elite circles. They're trying to restrict admission into those elite circles. I would say that in a country like South Africa, we don't actually need as many university graduates. We need more people with skills. And the only place they can learn those skills is either on the job in this country, because there's no way that the CETAs are doing their job. They're all like parastatals, effectively. Some of them are better than others, it's worth saying. Some of them are trying very hard. Some of them are just absolutely useless. But for most young people in this country, they're going to only learn on the job, right? And without internships being available, I know how passionate you are about this too. Where do they learn? Where do they learn? We don't need more lawyers. We definitely don't need more lawyers. We don't need any more philosophy graduates. I mean, those are always great, but they're not going to boost the economy. What we need is people with skills. We need people who can fix things, build things, repair things. Those are the people we're looking for in South Africa. And that's also where there's a huge opportunity for us to develop manufacturing, to work where people have, you know, skills and crafts that are available to be exported internationally. Those are things we should be working on. And you don't need universities for those. And I think these universities, they slowly but surely talking themselves out of a job. Which is ironic, because a lot of people go to universities so they can get a job. But the reality is, like, a lot of these universities, and I think the pandemic had something to do with this too, people were like, whoa, hang on a second. University for many people is just an extension of your parents' house for an extra few more years while you live on a campus and you get food and accommodation. And you come out with a degree that's not particularly helpful, that can't be applied in the real world. And for most South Africans, they look at that and they go, nah, I'm not paying the kind of fees that they're asking for that. It's expensive. That's expensive accommodation and food, you know? So it's something to think about.
No, but you know what we also need? We also need knowledge creators. We need research and thinkers. Mm-hmm. We need people to create new knowledge systems. So
yes.
Somebody in the comments here was talking about how this tribal system that we were talking about is so kind of like the Dark Ages, coming out of the Dark Ages. But I think what we need is we need deeper understanding of what works in those environments and how we can pull that up into the rest of how we do things and the rest of how communities are organized.
Yeah.
I think we need, and you know, on the one hand, I absolutely agree that we need more practical skills like plumbing and boiler making.
Sure.
But I also think that we need a hang of a lot more thinking skills, more individuals doing more research about new ways of doing things or what worked and that we can tinker with to make new, right? So I think about Israel and the fact that out of a desert, they have created essentially a land that can produce grapes as big as your head. and export them all over the world. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do that because they had plumbers. They did that also because they have lots of researchers kind of going, how do we use hydroponics to better our country?
But don't you think, those kinds of people that expand the knowledge base and that do research in these areas, those are your masters and your PhD and your
absolutely,
you know, those are the people at the very high end of higher education. And absolutely, I don't have a problem with that. What I'm saying is we're churning out all these bachelors of like arts degrees, which are, I don't know that that's really been a good use of people's money. I say that as someone who studied in the humanities, you know, so I'm allowed to be self-critical about this. I don't think it was useful. I believe that all those things, it was nice to study, but those are things I could have read about in my own spare time. It does nothing, and it proves nothing, and it is not a gateway into any job. And that piece of paper is pretty much worthless that says I've got history and political science and international relations and that I studied those things at university. It means zero. And I'm not going to contribute to the knowledge base in any way. You taught me more in the first half hour of this show this morning about the system of tribal councils in this country than I would have learned at any of the major universities. I can guarantee that in a bachelor's degree.
And that for me is precisely the point. You've got to start somewhere, right? So the fact that we have this huge network of tribal councils in South Africa and we have not as yet,
no one studied them.
Distilled what it is that worked and how they were able to hold for so long, hold peace and hold community relations that work and have lived for all these centuries. The fact that we haven't done that is really and you need both.
Why hasn't someone at one of the universities done a study? And forgive me if I don't know that there is such a thing. Maybe there is. Maybe someone has studied this. Why hasn't someone decided and discovered and distilled and explained the taxi system in South Africa in a detailed, systematic way where we can actually see who runs the taxi business in South Africa, where we can see what percentage of ownership is held where, how the drivers pay, how the owners reimburse, who actually owns the taxis, you know, the SA Taxi Company we need to know about. Like, no one's gone into detail about that. The only people who know that are probably some bureaucrats in the Department of Transport, and even they have probably a tiny slice of the total overall picture in their purview. I would love to know more about that because it's so, so influential and so powerful in this country. But, you know, instead, we'll study like American, you know,
so
gender grievance stuff. That'll be the priority.
Recently retired, you say that. I met a professor who's recently retired and he used to be head of logistics because that taxi stuff you're talking about is logistics at UJ. Mm-hmm. And he had one of his PhD students was actually doing a study about buses and taxis in the township. That was his PhD paper. So there is a study like that. And I just
have
a very fascinating conversation
I must look this up.
Old man about it.
I must look this up. Clearly I'm missing out. All right.
Because that information is important as we develop our cities. So as
for
Johannesburg and Pretoria merge into one through Midrand, right, it's incredibly important to understand how to plan the city and plan the roads and plan around all of those things and all of those networks.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Well, one quick thing to bring us full circle this morning, because we love these stories that bring us all the way around. Tshwane is to be without water for 53 hours in some places. Now, this is a big story. So we were talking about water earlier, saying how in the rural areas, this is the most important concern for most people, is running water that is clean and that you can turn a tap open and the water will come out. So the city of Tshwane will be shutting down the water supply in various parts on Thursday. That's today. That means residents could expect to have water shortages for up to 53 hours in some places. Rand Water's team of technicians will be conducting a tie-in of the newly installed pipeline to the existing S4 pipeline. It is planned to start at 5 o'clock this afternoon and will end at 10 o'clock on Saturday. And it's expected to take a total of 53 hours. Residents are urged to use water sparingly during this time to prevent reservoirs from running dry. They should also ensure that they store sufficient water that will sustain them for the duration of the shutdown. So there's some good advice from someone called Lindela Mashiho. Any relation, Pumi? No, I'm going to assume not. Water tankers and bowsers will be on standby. We'll be on standby for alternative water supply. The city of Tshwane apologizes for the inconvenience, but they are going to be maintaining things. So they're going to shut down the Cornwall Hill Reservoir, the Corribrick plant, the Gasfontein Reservoir, and a whole lot of others, including Moroletta, Queenswood, Cinnaville, Waverley, Valeria. So it sounds like it's going to affect a lot of people. Mamelodi, Kudu's Neck, Kilner Park, Eersterust, all of these places will be affected. So go on, check what's going on, because it may affect you. And I think it's probably a good idea that people are made aware of this stuff so that you can take the necessary precautions. Otherwise, you're going to have no running water until Saturday from this evening until 10 o'clock Saturday morning. Make sure that you've taken care of all of that so you don't end up with nothing coming out of the tap.
So for people who've not lived in areas with lots of like water shortages like that, can I just give you one small piece of advice?
Sure.
So how you flush your toilet is you fill the water in the cistern.
Yes.
You don't throw it into the, you put
Correct.
The water into the
cistern. And you put, and if you're really sharp, you put a brick in the cistern as well. So it takes up some of the space so that each flush is just a little bit less. Right, Pumi?
Yeah. Just.
Don't pretend you
don't
know.
Something I learned.
Don't pretend you don't know
growing
about
up in the hood.
That thing with the brick in the cistern. That's important information.
Because sometimes people who've always had like running water in their toilets don't know these things.
Mm-hmm.
You think that the water must go. No, the water must go into the cistern. Unless you have one of those fancy toilets where you can't even see the cistern.
Yeah, well, you just have a
then
button.
I'm sorry, Matt.
No. Do you know what I want to put in just as a final thought here? And we can discuss this maybe on another show because we're not going to have time in the burning platform. I want to put in a urinal because that uses much less water. And I live in this house as a guy on my own. My bathroom is just for me. And I don't see any problem with having a toilet and a urinal. And I think a urinal will use less water. You can stand up. It's very convenient. I'm going to put one in.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
That is a great idea. Corona's Boring also got a really good one because also you forget to do this. If there's no running water, turn off your geyser. It will like burn your element.
Mm-hmm. Very good idea. Don't pay an electrician.
See, don't say we don't love you.
Yeah.
Giving you practical advice to live your waterless lives.
So as Corona's Boring says, don't pay an electrician 1,200 to 1,500 rand to change the geyser element. Switch off your geysers if you're going to be in an area where they're switching off the water. Obviously, that's if you know. And by the way, so this happened to my brother and sister-in-law. Last bit of advice on this one. If they're going to shut down the water, make sure your children have closed the taps because the kids turned on the tap the other night. And, you know, the kid will turn the tap all the way open because nothing's coming out. And then they just leave it. And then the next day, they wake up to water all over the floor. Flood. You don't need that. It happened to my brother and sister-in-law. It also happened to my neighbors. So your children must be taught to close the taps, even if nothing comes out. Okay? Really important, useful information that. All right, we will see you in a minute for the burning platform. Got plenty to talk about this morning. Just get your thinking caps on. If you've got any questions, any comments, anything you want to talk about in particular, we're going to be doing that next. That's coming right up. CliffCentral.com.